It's WKAR's current state for Tuesday, January 15th. Good morning. I'm your host, Mark Bayshore. We opened yesterday's first edition of Current State with a chat with Governor Rick Snyder, and we got a little update here from that conversation that happened yesterday. At one point, I asked Governor Snyder about the MEDC's decision to include information or allude to the right-to-work legislation in a Pure Michigan ad that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. And here is part of how the governor responded to that question.
The MEDC has been running a Pure Michigan business campaign for the last year and a half. And they were making decisions about continuing their normal campaign process of promoting Michigan. So I view it as it's in their normal course of business to say, hey, these activities are going on in Michigan that companies should look to bring jobs to our state.
Well, yesterday, we got a little update on that. Yesterday at the Lansing Center, speaking after his address to the Michigan Agribusiness Association, the governor kind of altered what he said yesterday. He said, and I quote, this is from Paul Egan in the Detroit Free Press, "I would not have been emphasizing one issue the way it was emphasized in that ad. I would have preferred that it had had a much broader definition," those are his words, "of what makes Michigan a desirable place to locate a business, including elements such as the elimination of the Michigan business tax in 2011. So make of that what you will, okay? In the meantime, Current State welcomes Lansing Police Chief Teresa Szymanski to our microphones this morning. Yesterday, Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero and Flint Mayor Dane Walling joined forces in downtown Lansing along with Chief Szymanski. This was on the one-month anniversary of the Newtown, Connecticut shootings. They and others demanded that the U.S. Congress enact, in their words, sensible new gun laws. Bernero and Walling are among more than 100 U.S. mayors belonging to the group Mayors Against Illegal Guns. The group is calling for requiring criminal background checks for all gun sales, a ban on military-style assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, and making gun trafficking a federal crime. And Chief Teresa Szymanski was at that gathering here, and she joins me to discuss it and the bigger picture involving guns in Lansing. Good morning, Chief Szymanski.
Well, good morning, Mark. Thank you for having me on this morning, and congratulations. What a wonderful setup you have here.
Thank you. We're off to a pretty good start.
I would say so.
And we're glad to have you here this morning, considering everything that went down yesterday. We all just read, being just 15 days into the new year, we all just read that there were a dozen homicides in Lansing in 2012. That was the most in a few years. It's not much above average, but as chief of police in Lansing, what kind of impact would the measures that were called for yesterday, what kind of impact, if they were passed, would they have on crime in Lansing?
You know, Mark, it was, I applaud Mayor Bonero and Mayor Dan from Flint and my brothers and sisters in law enforcement. They stood up there yesterday to promote and beg and plead with Washington to eliminate some of this gun violence by the three things that they've proposed. And that would make a huge impact in our community, and it would make a huge impact in law enforcement. It would give our men and women in law enforcement are out there working hard every day, and it would give us some additional tools, some additional safeguards that would help protect us and also protect the community from violence. Because our police officers don't know when they walk up on traffic stops or encounter people what they're going to see. I mean, it's mm-hmm. game on every time. And this ban on these assault weapons and this federal trafficking of crime and background checks is key. Getting guns off the streets is key, and these three things would make a big difference in some of those things.
Now, the state legislature just passed significant changes to the law to streamline and speed up conceal and carry permits at the expense, some say, of safety. Now, I know your department is still analyzing what the new law means exactly. You're still digesting all of that. I totally understand that.
Sure.
But let's back up just a little bit. Why don't you walk me through the gun permitting process before these changes? What is that process like?
Absolutely. At the Lansing Police Department, what we do is we issue permits to purchase. So if an individual wants to come down to the LPD, they can get a purchase permit. They then take that to go buy their handgun or whatever gun they want to buy. Okay,
right.
So they take it to the gun store. We don't deal with CCWs. CCW is carrying concealed weapons.
It's the county, right?
That's the county, correct. There's a board, a gun board, that's Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth and Stuart Dunning oversees. So if an individual wants to have a permit to carry a concealed weapon, they have to go through the county gun board to obtain that permit. There's also something called open carry in Michigan, where individuals are allowed to openly carry weapons, handguns, and we've seen a lot of that. And the laws on that are pretty intense, that they just have to be in plain view. So you can carry, as a citizen walking down the street, a gun in a holster on your belt, as long as it's not covered by your suit coat or a jacket. It's in plain view. It's called open carry. So I know we just went through a lot of that here recently this past year, over at the library, for example,
right,
in the city of Lansing, where we had some issues there. So,
how do the conceal and carry,
uh-huh,
and the open carry provisions impact your work?
They impact our work a great deal, because when a police officer comes upon an individual with a gun, they have to know the questions to ask, assuming that we have an individual that's cooperative. And it also impacts us in the sense that we're not allowed to, if a person is legal, has all the permits, and is legally for CCW, that's someone we would not arrest, okay? If they are openly carrying and they are following all the rules, that's another individual that we must allow them to have their gun and go about our business. So those are the contacts that we have to make, and we have to decipher what they are on the streets on a daily basis.
That sounds tricky.
It is. It's complicated.
You got to know what you're doing.
You do.
Now, in Michigan, the permit is county-based, as we pointed out.
It is.
What sort of information does Ingham County provide you when you need to go through them? If you come into a weapon after a crime, what's it like tracing that weapon?
Absolutely. Well, in Lansing, we have a great partnership with ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Yeah.
We actually have agents assigned to us right in the Lansing Police Department at the North Precinct. So if we come across a gun crime, or if we come across a gun used in a crime, what we'll do is we'll use our partners from the ATF. We have a liaison officer also that will assist us in trying to track down the serial number and the origin of where that weapon came from.
And generally, are you successful more often than you're not? How does that play out?
Well, successful more often than not, yes. I think so. Unless, of course, the weapon has been defaced, the serial number has been removed, and those types of things. But we're able to track down a fair amount of them, but a lot of times, you know, it's kind of a hit and miss on some of them. But we're successful, and we also use our partners at the Michigan State Police and the Crime Lab.
Now, you recently had quite a success, and this was brought out at yesterday's meeting in a collaborative investigation with ATF on rounding up an awful lot of guns and putting away a lot of people, arresting a lot of people.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
Absolutely. Last Thursday, the Lansing Police Department joined our federal partners, ATF and the U.S. Marshals, and had 19 individuals were arrested. 19 individuals were indicted either on state or federal charges involving gun charges, and we went through our whole community and made a sweep and arrested those individuals and brought them to jail. So there's pending charges on 19 individuals.
Now, one witness, I've got to bring up the Savemore shooting that happened early on New Year's Day. We got off to a pretty rough start in Lansing.
Yes, we did.
With regard to gun violence just hours into the new year. One, according to the reports that I read, that everybody read, one witness to that shooting it was on Willow, right?
That's correct.
Willow. One young man died. But one witness claimed that 30 shots were fired in that incident. What was the weapon there, or are you not able to comment because it's an ongoing investigation?
Mark, that's an open investigation. It's
yeah.
an ongoing investigation. We currently do have one individual in custody for that. The investigation remains, and we're hoping to additional charges will be forthcoming on additional suspects on that. And you're right, it did take the tragic life of one individual, and it was not the way to start the new year.
No, it was very rough. But the 30 shots thing I think it jumped out at everybody, and given the nature of yesterday's event,
absolutely.
So It also, your success last week with the ATF collaboration kind of begs the question, how can the community do more? What should the individual citizen at large, how can they help you do your job more?
Mark, that's a great question, and I appreciate you asking that. It's about community awareness. It's about community engagement. It starts at the home. It starts having conversations at the dinner table with your family, talking about safety and gun violence. It talks about those issues. If you have guns in your home and you don't want them any longer for whatever reason, please turn them into authorities. You know, the Lansing Police Department's working on a gun buyback program. We've had one in the summer, which was very successful. We're planning a second one. But you don't have to wait to have a gun buyback program. If you have weapons in your home and you no longer want them, please turn them into authorities. You know, that eliminates the opportunity for someone to come in and steal them and put them in a person's hands
of
that
course.
Shouldn't have them.
Of course.
Be vigilant. And I love Neighborhood Watch. Neighborhood Watch works. Be vigilant. If it looks wrong, if it looks bad, if it looks illegal, please contact the Lansing Police Department or the authorities that you live in. Be a good witness. Be aware of your surroundings and know what's going on. So engage your family, engage your neighbors, engage your friends. Talk about this. Get rid of guns if you don't want them, if you don't need them. Be a good witness, get engaged in Neighborhood Watch. Those are some things that you can do, just simple things to get involved in this.
Lansing Police Chief Teresa Szymanski, we'll continue this conversation again soon. Okay, I would really like that, and this issue is not going away, so we hope we can have you back again
Absolutely.
Soon. Teresa Szymanski here on Current States. Good morning. Leap CEO Bob Trezise went on a tear a couple of Sundays ago in the Lansing State Journal and ran down a long list of reasons he's enthused about the Lansing area economy. And we're happy to welcome the Leap CEO to WKAR's Current State, along with his colleague Jeff Smith, whose title is Co-Director, New Economy Division at the Lansing Economic Area Partnership. Good morning, guys. Happy New Year.
Morning, Mark.
Good
morning.
It's going to be a good year for us.
Good to see you. Yeah, we're off to a good start here. Bob, your piece included 19 projects on economic developments, and at the end you said you could go on. What's the catalyst for all of this activity in Lansing? And by that I mean, why here? Why now?
Well, I think in the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a profound mindset change in the psychology of our region. I really do. It's finally happened. People, actually, like Jeff Smith, deserves a huge amount of credit because he started the region's first incubator 5 years ago in downtown East Lansing, the TIC. MSU, President Simon, has become very aggressive and started up an entire unit, basically, that it's working to commercialize product out of Michigan State University. Mayor Bonero, there's nobody more effective with businesses. I'm always amazed when I see him in a room with a business. It's incredible what he has high standards and demand, has high demands. In other words, we've raised the standards, our own expectations. Maybe that's a response to an economic collapse, basically, in 2008. I'm not really sure, but whatever the impetus is, you have a lot of very competent people. You have leaders who are very motivated and have a set of high standards for us. We have to believe in ourselves, Mark. I mean, I grew up in the city. We kind of have had a self-esteem problem here. We always think, oh, shoot, little Lansing, we can't do it. Oh, by the way, I think the power station project on the riverfront in downtown was always a representative, a symbol of the impossible, what we can't do on our skyline.
Right.
Every day, people went under that crummy ramp in that dark passageway and looked at an empty building on our riverfront in a rustic falling down river trail in a city market that you know, not many people enjoy it anymore.
No, that was huge. And we no doubt about it.
Because now it's a symbol of what's possible. And the Ides, who then do the Knapps building, they specifically are doing that building because of what they watched us do on the power station. They said, we never thought you'd be able to do it.
Now, all of this new activity that you alluded to in your piece, how does it break down in terms of manufacturing and other sectors? Is there a pattern that's taking shape in terms of the kinds of economic activity going on?
There's not a pattern, and I think that's been part of our success. I think it's important that there is not a pattern to it. If you look at that list and look at our pipeline that we know exists for 2013, what we did at LEAP in 2012, it's across the board. Some of it is manufacturing. Some of it is corporate headquarters. Some of it is startup business. Some of it is expansion, whether it's nanotechnology or biotechnology, and that's the way we need to be. I want to do it all. We can do it all. Why is it that we can only do one thing at a time? We can actually do it all at a level of excellence.
Jeff Smith, what's your take on all this activity?
No, I completely agree with Bob. I think it's a mindset that has to change, and I think that mindset has fully changed. You start to see a lot of people coming back into the region. What's nice is that we can't measure everything now. Before, we'd be able to count exactly how many bricks were added to this building, how much paint was put on the outside of this facility. And now, if you look around the region, it is really difficult to keep up with as much construction and activity as going on. And that's what you need to do as a community, is to stop, you know, concerning yourself over the ones and twos and look at the bigger picture and see that there's so much activity that you can't count it anymore. That's what's really great about what's going
nice,
on.
Nice problem to have. So yeah. Much going on, we can't keep track of it all.
Lansing is hot. You know, and I use that term in a regional way. Lansing is hot. We have to embrace that. And I would say, Mark, there's always a temptation to halt or slow down or something like that. This is absolutely the time to hit the pedal and to seize our momentum and demand that it's not good enough even where we are now. We're all excited. There's a lot of evidence. Number one in the state of Michigan, number six in the whole country, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, for job growth in the smart sector area. That's real. That's not just some list. Yeah. And we need to seize that momentum and hit the pedal hard. This is not the time to say, oh, good enough. That's old Lansing thinking. This is about the new Lansing. We want more. We want to be big. We want to be better.
You were the first person that I know of to refer to Lansing as America's Accelerator Region. And this was in the Lansing State Journal piece mentioning both FRIB and activity at NioWave. Now, was this poetic and we know you're a poet. Was this poetic license, or are there others who are thinking of our region as America's Accelerator Region? You capitalized every one of those.
Yeah,
like
I did.
It's a phrase that's in play.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's probably more plagiarism because that comes straight from NioWave, which is an amazing company, a company that did not exist 6 years ago, now with 55 employees. And they're one of the top firms in the world, literally, dealing with new laser technologies that have been are an offshoot of the accelerator program and personnel at Michigan State University. And so it's what we do, though, is we don't want to be just settle with that one business or just with the effort or just with the accelerator. How do we build an entire industry? How do we become the Silicon Valley for magnet and laser technology built out of these different areas? And as it turns out, NioWave is insistent that no one else really is doing this. Mm-hmm. We have the accelerator here at Michigan State. Hardly anyone else does. That makes us puts us in a very exclusive club worldwide. And the point is to build an industry around those assets, and it's happening right now.
Are you more encouraged or discouraged regarding Right to Work's future impact in Lansing? Got a take on that?
Were you looking at Jeff or me?
I honestly, you know what's nice? I don't think it matters. I honestly think that there's so much going on in the activities of the economics of Lansing. I don't think it matters a whole lot either way. I think what you're finding is that companies are growing very quickly from a startup stage. So we have so many new startup companies coming into this area and so many people coming from other markets coming into this area that they're not really that concerned about that right now. That may be something that they start addressing and facing as they start really amassing employees. But really, it's about getting more activity and more startups coming into this community. The more that happens, the more you create a real culture for innovation.
I agree.
Jeff, you focus on startups in the area. You're suggesting there's a respectable amount of startup activity.
Absolutely,
in Lansing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the more you could cultivate that, I think what's happening now is that the startups are demanding more services and more activities and more available retail. You're going to start seeing a lot more demand for higher end, more unique specialty food stores, more unique specialty retail. You're going to see that demand coming from people that are coming into this market from other markets or individuals that are starting new jobs here, new startup companies. Those innovative people are going to start demanding innovative things.
Now, that would seem to be encouraging as far as retaining college graduates as well. Everybody talks about this. We got to hold on to a higher percentage of our Michigan State grads here in the Lansing area. Is the activity going on now suggesting that that will happen, or is it happening now?
Well, actually, yes, it is happening now. You never let a good recession go to waste. And when the market turns south, it means that the market is south nationally. So in the past, we had students that were graduating from MSU or graduating from local universities and colleges and then going to Chicago or Austin or San Francisco or wherever it might be and bunking with a friend of theirs and saying, you know what, it doesn't matter. I'll get a job in the next 6 or 7 months anyway. It doesn't matter. I'll find a good place. Well, when the economy turns south, that job that you thought you were going to get for 6 or 7 months down the road turns into a year and a half, and suddenly you're not moving into a friend's place in Chicago. You're staying put. And the staying put has actually helped a lot in getting more people staying put. Now a friend stays put, another friend stays put, a family member stays put, and you start to build family here. And when you build family here, it's always something to come back to and you feel comfortable.
Okay. It's definitely happening.
Okay. We're just about out of time here, so we got to curtail this, but we want to have both of you guys back soon to continue this conversation because this is something that it seems to be changing every week, every month, and it's pretty exciting. So there is no doubt there's a spark to the area here, and we want to have you guys back to talk about how this continues to unfold.
We'd love to be on.
No time for a poem today,
okay,
though, Bob.
Okay, I'll do it next time, Mark.
Okay, Bob Trezise, Leap CEO, Jeff Smith, also of Leap. Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks very much.
Coming up in the second half hour of Current State today, we talk with classical pianist Minsoo Soan of East Lansing, who discusses his Carnegie Hall debut and his upcoming recital here closer to home. He's a professor of piano here at Michigan State University. And I think just about everybody's heard the words, "Thank God for Michigan," attributed supposedly to President Abraham Lincoln. We're going to learn more about Michigan's role in the U.S. Civil War from the great Roger Rosentrater, who's a professor of history here at Michigan State as well. Current State continues in just a bit. Stay with us. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Pianist Minsoo Soan made his Carnegie Hall debut this past fall, 2012. In 2011, Soan recorded Johann Sebastian Bach's epic hour-long plus keyboard masterpiece, The Goldberg Variations. Soan's Bach was named one of the top classical recordings of the year by the New York Times. Minsoo Soan has toured extensively throughout North America, Europe, and Israel as a soloist and a chamber musician. He is assistant professor of piano at Michigan State University's College of Music. Tomorrow evening at 7:30, Soan performs a solo concert at MSU's Cook Recital Hall. Now, Wednesday's program is as wide-ranging as Soan's career, with works by Brahms, Beethoven, and Webern. Minsoo also includes an homage to Bach by the great 19th century composer Franz Liszt, widely regarded as the most famous pianist of his day. WKAR's Peter Wharf spoke with Minsoo Soan about tomorrow night's program and Liszt, the musical superstar of his era.
That's when he was having his peak as a pianist, and when when he was performing all over the Europe. But, you know, people forget that in his later part of his life, he was one of the most religious figure, and he taught so many students. He was as dedicated as a teacher, as a performer when he was young. So, a man of many, many different characteristics. I think it's been said that he's one of the first pianists who ever started that phenomena of, you know, playing by heart. To me, he should be considered one of the, if not the best, pianist in the history of piano playing. But I think he will be the first one who admit that he had a great reverence for Bach, and which is quite evident in one of my programming for the concert.
Liszt makes this connection with Bach, a composer who is so associated with spiritual music and liturgical music, and music that was heard on a regular basis in the church. Is there a connection then between, as you said earlier in this conversation, Liszt's own spiritual direction and connection with religion later in his life?
I don't know if this particular piece has anything to do with it, but if you look at a big chunk of his later works, it's deeply, deeply related with the religious part of his life and his everyday routine. Beethoven's Opus 109 is actually quite similar in terms of musical structure with the reverence variations for piano, because both pieces have sort of fantasy-like first movement, and then second movement is just very, very quick scherzo. And then finally, at the third movement, this is for both pieces, Webern and Beethoven, returns to a strictly variation form. Of course, Beethoven's Opus 109 is not considered a variation as a whole. It's a sonata, but the last movement is one of the famous Beethoven's variation, of course. And at the end, the theme comes back, almost having the same effect as Goldberg variation when the aria comes back at the very end. So all these musical connections that I found playing with all those music, I find it very interesting. But the, in Vervon's case, I think audience will find it quite unfamiliar. But for me, the purpose and the challenge is to make this music like Beethoven.
Minsu Son is assistant professor of piano at the College of Music at Michigan State University. He performs a recital at Cook Recital Hall on the MSU campus tomorrow night at 7:30. Professor Son, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, this is Peter Whorf.
Thank God for Michigan. Those were the words of President Abraham Lincoln as he watched Michigan men arrive by train in the early days of the American Civil War. Michigan soldiers were the first to make their way east from the western states. The state of Michigan sent 90,000 men to war, nearly a quarter of our male population. About one in six died in service. The entire first graduating class of the Michigan Agricultural College was excused early, so that they could join the Union Army. Life and Death in the Civil War is currently on display in the exhibition Michigan in the Civil War at the MSU Museum. The exhibit marks the ongoing sesquicentennial of the war between the states. Drawn from the museum's historic collection, Michigan in the Civil War highlights our state's connections to America's bloodiest conflict. Uniforms, weapons, camp goods, medical equipment, even some surviving Civil War hardtack are all included. WKAR's Peter Whorf joined MSU history professor Roger Rosentrater for a look at Michigan in the Civil War. Rosentrater began the tour by examining some of the tools of war and describing the Michigan fighting man.
Michigan has had a lot of cavalrymen, per capita more cavalrymen than any other northern state. And this particular weapon, the Sharps, or some of the other carbines that were out there, allowed, Spencer is another carbine they've got on display, it allowed them greater firepower.
Why was it that Michigan had a larger percentage of cavalrymen?
You know, that's a great question. Maybe we didn't like to walk as much. I'm not exactly sure why we had more, but it may have been. At the outset of the war, the federal government didn't want volunteer cavalrymen. They said there's no way you can train or outfit a cavalryman as a volunteer. And again, the war was going to be short, and we weren't going to need to go through this very intense process of training cavalrymen. Obviously, that changes. And part of Michigan's situation may have been certain folks back home who took the initiative. There was a congressman from Grand Rapids by the name of Kellogg, for example, who worked very hard, got permission from the War Department, organized several regiments of cavalry. And four of them would ultimately be formed into a brigade. That was a rarity to have four from the same state. And they would fight in the Eastern Theater, most prominently at the Battle of Gettysburg, under the command of a new brigadier general by the name of George Custer. So, again, firepower, the ability to move, and horses clearly allow them to move, but what they did in the Civil War a lot wasn't these grandiose cavalry fights with swords. There are swords on display here as well. It was generally you take your cavalrymen and you got them to a location. Three men would allow their horses to be held by a fourth man while those three used their additional firepower like you've got here in a Spencer or a various carbines, and you've got the ability to move. That was the whole idea. You could get to a particular place fairly quickly, and then you've got additional firepower. And that works to their advantage by mid-war, and then clearly a distinct advantage as we move into the latter part of the war. The South suffering from a loss of horses, for example, not as able to replace them as the North was able to. Here's another artifact here, Harris Hillard's 3rd Cavalry Decorative Box. The reason I noticed it here is it talks about at the end of the war, because what happens, getting back to Michigan cavalrymen, is when the war is over, as was normally the case, you know, the Southerners go home to the destruction that's been left behind. Well, Northerners said, we won the war, we want to come home. And most of them did come home. There were some exceptions, though. One group of exceptions was the Michigan Cavalry Brigade, because they were sent west to deal with the what was then perceived as an Indian problem, right? And we need veteran, skilled cavalrymen. So you can imagine these guys. They'd just gone through the Grand March in late May of 1865 in Washington, and they're going home, or so they think. And as they make that train trip, when they get to St. Louis, Missouri, and the train's not turning north, and no one's told them, by the way, you know, we're just getting on the train, boys. So they finally end up in the Dakota Territories, and they spent about the next 6 to 9 months out west, taking casualties in creating and doing a part of what they were supposed to do, which was to protect settlers from the Indian threat, or the perceived Indian threat, as it were. Then to show you the gratitude the government had when they finally mustered them out, they said, all right, you guys can go home now. Good luck. And they didn't make provision for them to come home, so they ended up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and they had to get fortunately, the Michigan Congressional Delegation was able to find some money and bring them home. Otherwise, they'd probably still be there, or maybe they would have settled in Utah, for all I know. But I thought it was a little bit unfair to say, you know, we're going to make you stay in. I mean, they were in the Army. They had to stay. I mean, they couldn't just go home. They certainly were not excited at all. They had joined up to fight the Confederates, not to fight the Sioux.
That's an amazing story that probably not many people know, that these were soldiers who thought the war was over. They were put on a train, assuming they were on their way home, and then they were taken out west to fight Indians.
Yeah. And again, it was quite a shock, I'm sure, to them to suddenly say, okay. And they were fairly disgruntled, as you might imagine. Matter of fact, there are a number of instances of guys deserting. I mean, as soon as a boat stopped somewhere, and they had already been told at this point, they immediately got, and they in some cases they were not allowed off the boat, you know, because they went up the Missouri River. That's where the boat comes into, and they said, well, we're not letting guys off, because in the previous stops, whenever we get off, people don't come back.
Yeah. So, Roger Rosentrater is history professor at Michigan State University. We're touring the exhibit today, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary at the Michigan State University Museum. Can we step over here to something that might be very familiar to people who are interested in the Civil War? It's one of the smallest items in the display and in any Civil War display, but probably has one of the greatest impacts throughout the war and throughout the history of war.
Right. Well, you're looking at a mini ball, and it was named after its French inventor, Claude Monet. Now, we can't say Monet as Americans, so we had to call it mini, but it is the .58 caliber cartridge that was used in your basic Civil War musket. And there is a cartridge, a paper cartridge below that, which shows you, and if you were to open that, there would be black powder in there as well as that particular bullet. So if you take the Springfield, which is up here on display, there is a ramrod, and what you have to do is go through a 9-step process to load this thing. And we can't do it on the radio, but nevertheless, you have to take the cartridge, you got to tear the cartridge, you got to put the powder in, you got to ram the powder, put the bullet in, ram the bullet in, then you have to put the ramrod back because you're going to need it again, right? Then you have to put a cartridge, a percussion cap, as it were, near the base of the rifle, and then you're ready to fire. I mean, and it's if you're really good, you are supposed to be able to do this 3 times a minute. It's pretty mind-boggling, I think, when I think about the process involved.
I can't imagine doing that fast while on a battlefield with guys shooting at me.
No, and that's a very good point. You know, people are shooting at you. There's a very interesting scene in the movie Glory, which some of the listeners would have certainly have seen, where one of the young recruits is firing away, and suddenly the officer, Matthew Broderick, comes up and...
Attention, company!
As you were. You're a good shot, Private.
Thank you, sir. Squirrel hunting.
You ever killed a man?
No, sir.
But you're handy with a gun.
Yes, sir.
Reload. Faster! Faster! Discharge your weapon. Do it! Now do it again, only this time, I want it done quickly. Faster. Reload. Faster.
And he's firing the pistol in his ear because he's saying, hey, this is the distraction you have to deal with.
And he's saying faster and faster while shooting in the soldier's ear.
You know, as opposed to, oh, yeah, I'm just kind of shooting bottles or whatever. Now, the range of this particular bullet, because it's rifled, the barrel of the rifle is got grooves in it. And that allows this bullet to travel accurately about 400 to 500 yards. Why that's important is that the tactics haven't kept up with the weaponry. And if you can start, as I explained to my students, if you can start hitting people at 3 or 4 football fields and you're marching, not necessarily running, you know, even if you're loading slowly, you can do a pretty good job and a lot of damage.
The tactics were based on older methods that weren't taking into account a more accurate weapon.
Well, a smoothbore musket has a range of maybe 100 yards. So think one football field. So if I can still, and it still gets loaded somewhat similarly, so if I can load it once, you know, crossing 100 yards, or again, as I tell my students, you know, how quickly can you run that 100-yard dash? Now, they didn't run a lot in the Civil War. They marched because having that massed firepower was very important. But you can still cover 100 yards fairly quickly. And again, if you've got bayonets and there's a lot of you, you're going to intimidate the guy at the other end, even if he's got the first shot off. But at 4 or 5 football fields, that's a whole different process.
He's still far away.
He is, and again, that's a long distance to try to travel, and you can get several rounds off. And again, if the idea is massing, I mean, bringing together literally hundreds, if not thousands, of rifles at one time, and then firing fairly routinely, again, covering that terrain is almost impossible. If you think about the Battle of Fredericksburg, for example, the Yankees covered about a 500 to 600 yard open field. The Confederates were at the top behind a stone wall. There were several thousands of them at that stone wall so that someone could load and hand a weapon so they didn't have to even load themselves if they were in the front rank. But the point being is that after 14 continuous charges, the Yankees never got any closer than 40 yards.
Roger Rosentrater is history professor at Michigan State University. We've been looking at the exhibit, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary. Professor Rosentrater, thanks very much.
All right, thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And we'll have part two of this discussion with MSU history professor Roger Rosentrater tomorrow here on WKAR's Current State. Glad you're aboard here this morning. I'm Mark Bayshore. Current State is really lucky to have a really talented guy at the helm of our new program. Joe Lindstroth arrived barely a week ago, and because Joe's in charge, things are off to a great start. That's just between you and me. Don't tell anybody else that. But Joe Lindstroth joins me here right now to talk about your ideas about the future of this hour here on WKAR,
that's right.
A little bit about your background. Joe and I, by the way, we've been invited to speak to the Delta Waverly Rotary Club a little bit later on today out at Carrabba's on West Saginaw. So they've given us an opportunity to talk about what we have in mind here for Current State, and we do appreciate that invite an awful lot. But anyway, consider this your official welcome to WKAR, I guess, Joe.
Well, thank you, Mark. Thank you. You know, and you mentioned lunch today. I think that's the first of many opportunities we're going to be taking to get out in the community. We're going to take this show remotely, you know, to the different smaller communities that are in our listening area, basically, that spread from Grand Rapids to Ann Arbor. We'll do some remotes here in Lansing and East Lansing, you know, and just get out there.
I found myself, when people ask me about the show, I found myself always going and say, well, there's nothing we've really taken off the table. That's always kind of my default position. But I think you came to town with that same kind of vision for the show. We don't want to neglect the news or issues or policy, but we want to walk that tightrope between news, policy, and issues, and music, performance, travel, fitness, investing. It's the magazine type approach that we're trying to put together here.
I think that's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, we want to be serious. We want to address the issues like today with the Lansing police chief, but we also want to have a little fun. And I think most importantly, we want this to be the community show. We want the community and your involvement in this, whether you tweet us, email us, et cetera, give us feedback. We also want you to participate in some segments. We're going to be asking, you know, for your help on. And then I think together, you, myself, and every the staff here at WKAR and the community can produce, you know, a great show and make it a meeting place, a gathering place for this community to honestly discuss issues and have a good time.
We want it to be a community platform. And I think Joe and I and Peter Worf and everybody are on the same page as far as that goes.
And we'll get there.
You've got a neat idea that you're going to go into in a little bit more detail tomorrow called Neighbors in Action, and it kind of plays off that whole community involvement.
Exactly. This is, you know, our first of what I hope to be many different segments that'll be, you know, community produced, essentially. Neighbors in Action, basically we're going to do every Wednesday, where it will be listener nominated, and we're going to be having conversations with people and organizations who work to make this community a better place. So we would love your suggestions. In fact, we require them. This segment every Wednesday will be nominated by you, the listener. It could be an organization in your neighborhood, a neighbor, someone who lives next door who, you know, just happened to do something, for example, with the veterans. Whatever it is, please send us an email at currentstate@wkar.org. In the subject line, put Neighbors in Action. And then please tell us, you know, who or what organization you would like to nominate and why. Why are they important and what work are they doing? And a little contact information never hurt.
We've got about 30 seconds, but briefly tell our listeners about your experience in Eastern Europe. This will blow your mind.
Well, yeah, you know, I originally came from Chicago. I worked on a global affairs show there at WBEZ called Worldview. Fantastic show. And kind of got into that. You know, I've lived in the Balkans on and off for about 12 years, starting in 99 in Bulgaria. And I just kept going back. I own a small house there in Bulgaria in a small village. And I've done some reporting in Kosovo on the rebuilding wine industry and the parallel education systems. I just have a real fascination with the region.
A well-traveled guy, and now he belongs to us, Current State here at WKAR. Joe Lindstroth. Great to check in here.
Thank you, Mark. I'll see you on the other side of the glass.
We'll do it again. Okay. Joe Lindstroth here on Current State. All right. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we're going to preview the governor's State of the State address. I swear this is probably his most anticipated State of the State address yet. You thought the other two were much anticipated. I think the third time around probably qualifies as, it may qualify as number one. We're going to be joined by the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta, who covers the Capitol for us, and we're going to explore what he anticipates and other issues that the governor is likely to address in his State of the State address tomorrow night. There's other things planned as well. We hope you can join us at 9 o'clock. We want to thank a couple of people in particular. Harold Beer, our chief engineer, Kim Geiger in charge of the IT. They played a key role in getting Current State up to speed. We appreciate it a lot. See you tomorrow at 9, Current State on WKAR.